Hello, I'm Andrew Cadell. This is number 0536, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0536. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet William D. Chalmers, the event director for the Global Scavenger Hunt. Their next event will be the 16th annual one. What have they learned over the years?
You know what we've learned? We've learned that originally we thought it was all about the travel and all about the exotic destinations that we're going to and we take our travelers to, because we take them to 10 secret destinations each year. But what we found out, it's really about the participants. It's really about the people and how they interact with those places we go to and the other participants in the adventure.
Amy Ginsberg Bickel, the widow of Theodore Bickel and the co-author of Theodore Bickel's The City of Light. It started out as a short story that Theodore wrote for Hanukkah for a magazine back in 2014.
About a year ago, Nadine Epstein approached me if I would like to turn it into a book and publish it. And I did very much. So I expanded the story. So I about doubled the original story that Theo had written in his voice. I know his voice well enough to write as if I'm him. And then I added a foreword and an afterword and a couple of glossaries. And the little story turned into a really beautiful book for children. I think if he was here to see it, he would be immensely proud.
Caroline Weaver, owner of CW Pencil Enterprise, a pencil store in New York City. How did this shop come to be?
It was kind of, to be honest, my sort of like joke fantasy retirement job, this whole idea of a pencil shop. It's an object that I've been interested in for my entire life and that I've collected for my entire life. And as I got older and became more interested in the history of it and in the discovery of new pencils that I hadn't seen before through travel or just through talking to other people who are interested in analog tools, I realized that it would be really cool if there was a place where you could try out and see all the good pencils that exist from all over the world.
And we have lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0536, was Andrew Cadell, the principal partner for QIT Canada. Their Guardian software suite provides intuitive disaster management software and incident management solutions. And if you want to know what exactly all of that means, you can go to their website and find out more information, and you'll find the link to their website by going to our website at thestufffile.com. Just go to the show number that you just heard Andrew mention, and you'll find out all about it. Thank you very much, Andrew, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us on patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 61-year-old Peter Robbins has been released from prison. The former child actor from San Diego, best known as the voice of Charlie Brown in various Peanuts TV shows in the 1960s, has been in trouble repeatedly for stalking, threatening, and parole violations. He has been ordered to stay away from alcohol and drugs and to take anger management classes. Now, to celebrate his release, Robbins had his tattoo of Charlie Brown and Snoopy touched up. "It's a symbol to me of refurbishing my life," he says, and he's planning to write a book about his prison time. The planned title? Confessions of a Blockhead. Wow. His life really has been similar to when Charlie Brown tries to kick Lucy's football.
"I don't mind your dishonesty half as much as I mind your opinion of me. You must think I'm stupid."
An unnamed woman in College Station, Texas, says she noticed her bedroom door was open, even though she closed it, and it happened several times. She took a shower and went to bed. Her boyfriend was already asleep. After she lay down, she suddenly noticed a man standing in her bedroom. She woke up her boyfriend to chase the man out, who explained, "I'm just here to watch them have sex because where we from, we don't get that." Wow. Who is this guy, Chauncey Gardner?
I like to watch.
After the man ran, the woman went to wake up her roommate to tell her what happened. As they talked, the same man popped out of the roommate's shower and said, "I'm right here!" The woman's screams prompted arriving police to run in and subdue the man. 19-year-old Jordan Gibson was arrested and charged with criminal trespass. By the way, he's from Chapel, Florida. Well, we know that they get that in Florida because otherwise we would have run out of Florida man stories a long time ago. 50-year-old Milad Shaker, a family practice medical doctor in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania, was charged with multiple counts of illegally prescribing opioids to a female patient on multiple occasions, trading the drugs for sexual favors, as well as fraud for billing insurance for the treatments. In his defense in federal court, Shaker testified that opioids are like candy, and 10 to 20 opioid pills will not hurt you. Not surprisingly, Shaker was found guilty of 14 counts and faces up to 140 years in prison and fines of up to $3.5 million. But hey, don't worry about your safety in prison, Doc. Shivs are like toys. 10 to 20 stab wounds will not hurt you. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and speaking of prison, this next story could be listed under the heading of Governmental Pinheads in Action. Joey Peterson received a flyer that had relaxing tips that he could follow. Things like go on a picnic, or plant a tree, or put air freshener in your car. This type of touchy-feely advice might work for some people, but in the case of Peterson, it would have been difficult advice to follow under the circumstances. Avoid negative people was probably easier. That was also in the flyer. He was on his way into solitary confinement when he was given the flyer that included those tips. The Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla had adopted the document 101 Ways to Relieve Stress years earlier. Now, when it was pointed out to corrections officials that much of its advice was impossible for inmates, they said it missed the mark and it would be dropped. Peterson is a convicted murderer serving multiple life sentences. Relax, the list also said. You have the rest of your life. Yeah. You know, a story like this doesn't surprise me. As I've said many times over the years, when it comes to irony, nothing beats the prisons in New Hampshire. It's mentioned right there on their website that the New Hampshire Correctional Industries is responsible to produce all of the license plates in the state of New Hampshire. This is done under a special contract agreement with the New Hampshire Department of Safety. So, basically, prisoners behind bars get to make license plates for the state, and each one is stamped with the state's motto of "Live Free or Die." Nothing like rubbing it in, huh? Yeah. Anyway, let's talk to our first guest about something that prisoners don't get to do at all, and that's travel. William D. Chalmers is back on the program. He's the event director for the Global Scavenger Hunt. It's an annual travel adventure that takes adventurous travelers to 10 countries over 23 days in a competitive scavenger hunt to exotic locales. 2020 marks the 16th annual event. William joins us right now on the line from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Peter. How are you? Good to talk to you again.
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program with us. Now, we seem to talk about every 2 years or so about this, and we go back to actually close to the very beginning. I think I first talked to you about 16 years ago about these events. So now that you're coming up to the 16th annual event, you've got 15 behind you under your belt. What have you learned about putting on such a grand event each and every year?
Good question. That is a wonderful question to start off. You know what we've learned? We've learned that originally we thought it was all about the travel and all about the exotic destinations that we're going to and we take our travelers to, because we take them to 10 secret destinations each year. But what we found out, it's really about the participants. It's really about the people and how they interact with those places we go to and the other participants in the adventure.
So it's almost like, for instance, when I talk to stage actors and they do a play over and over and over again, they say that the difference is the audience. You're saying almost the same thing in relationship to the travelers.
Yeah, we don't have an audience, but it is the travelers and how they interact with each other. And, you know, it's interesting because I've had that same conversation with stage actors, and it's a combination of the interaction with the audience, but also sometimes their fellow actors are on cue or not on cue, and their biorhythms are up or down, and how they're reacting, and sometimes they're more emotional than other times. So it is. It's how the people interact, and it's really been unique in that regard. And over the years, we've always interviewed our travelers. We want to make sure they have good travel bona fides. They know what they're getting into. This isn't a sleep on the beach kind of situation. It's an adventure. We 99 out of 100 times we've been successful in that endeavor, but we have had a few people that didn't quite turn out the way they did on the telephone during the interview.
Now, there's a bit of a simplicity to what you do. You know, when people hear things like global scavenger hunt and they hear ideas of doing this year after year after year, they envision some kind of grand reality television show of some sort with big prizes at the end. This is not what this is, right?
That is not what this is. No, we've had prize money involved in this. This is the Travel World Championships, and there is a prize involved in that. You do get to come back. The winning team does get to come back the next year to defend their championship. So, in effect, they do get an around-the-world trip. But this is about visiting. We've visited 85 countries so far, and in each destination we go to, we want our travelers to hit the ground running and to trust strangers in strange lands doing scavenges. So it is not a production company in that regard. We've put together some documentary stuff, but we don't want to sensationalize it any more than it needs to.
How much travel do you get to do in order to put this whole thing together? I mean, you must go ahead and travel to these places or scout locations before you actually plan the scavenger hunt.
Of course. And that is probably one of the biggest reasons why I continue to do this, is because it does keep me out on the road. And it is exciting for me. Obviously, if the event's been to 85 countries, I've been to a lot more. I just came back from a trip that I was on and for 10 days visiting 3 countries. Coming home was no fun. It took me 28 hours to get home and 4 flights, but I did get home. But that's my life as a traveler, and trying to raise a 14-year-old son at the same time and keeping my tabs on him. It's tricky sometimes.
16th annual event coming up in 2020. How do you avoid the been there, done that aspect of doing this over and over again?
Well, that's a good one, too. We go. Every event is fresh, Peter. Every event. Every event is not. No two events have been the same. No two routes have ever been the same. We're constantly finding new areas of the world. I look at the world and I see 200 countries. And of those 200 countries, I can count on basically less than 2 hands places that I wouldn't go to. Somalia, Central African Republic, Syria. I can count them on 2 hands, which tells me that the world is a 95% conflict-free zone. And so I have 180 countries that I can go to. And so far we've been to 85. My goal is very soon to get to 100. And so every event is fresh and new because we go to fresh and new destinations.
Well, what you just mentioned touches on what I wanted to ask next, and that is both with technology and also the social situations and political situations in various places around the world. How has this adventure changed over the last 15 years? What has gotten easier? What has gotten harder?
Yeah, well, it's gotten easier, Peter. It's gotten much easier. When we first started, we had to carry tickets for everyone, paper tickets. That's gone by the wayside, clearly. When we first started, we had to fax hotels. Now we can do different technologies and communicating. It's gotten easier. It's gotten easier moving money around to paying for our our logistics. It's gotten easier because there are more regional traveler or regional airlines everywhere in the world. It's gotten easier because of communications. I believe this is the golden age of travel. You can be anywhere, anytime in 24 hours. The death of distance has taken place in the last decade or so.
It's called a global scavenger hunt. So what exactly happens when somebody arrives? Give us an example from the last year. Somebody arrives in a location, and what do they have to do?
Okay. For instance, last year, I think our second destination was Myanmar, and that we started in Yangon. And we would all land in the city. We would all get to the hotel and check in. And at that point, I would give everybody their instructions, a booklet of scavenges to do. There's no way they could do them all, so it's up to them and their partner to figure out what they can do. And on this particular occasion, we were in Myanmar for 5 nights, and they had different choices of cities to go to. They had Inle Lake they could go to, Mandalay, exotic Mandalay, and the Plains of Bagan, which is probably one of the most unique spiritual places in the world, where in front of us, no one knows about it, but there's probably 10,000 Buddha stupas of various sizes, from the size of a garage to a 10-story building, that are on this vast plain. And they would have to go out and have to figure out how to do the questions and answer why a temple was special, how a special food was made, learn how to do that, go to the market and find it. And they would have to trust strangers in strange lands during those 5 days figuring out these things. They can't use their technology.
The people travel in teams of two?
Yes. And I believe in the buddy system. We haven't lost anybody yet.
Okay. And how many teams are involved usually? Do you limit the amount of people who can participate?
We do. As I mentioned, we interview folks, and we pick 15 teams of two every year. We limit it to that. I know some people would like us to take more. Some people would like us to do this a couple times a year. I really don't have more than one of these events a year in me because of how long it takes to put together. And then 15 teams is more than enough. That's the dynamic of 30 people interacting with each other is a very unique process on an annual basis. And these are great travelers from all over the world. We've had participants from Canada and from the United States, from I think 18, 19 countries so far. We've had winners from Australia, New Zealand, England, Germany. We've had folks from all over the world participate.
And this by no means is a cheap experience. I mean, there's a cost to this, right?
Well, it's cheap, but it ain't free. No, it's $25,000. That's United States money, and American dollars. Sorry about that. It is $25,000. It's about $1,000 a day for a team, and that includes all your international airfare. It includes all your hotels. We stay in great places. About 40% of your meals and some great swag that we get from our sponsors that we give to all the teams. So there's lots of fun as far as that goes. But it is a 24-day commitment to people. And that actually is the biggest problem that we've had over the years, is actually getting the time off, especially with our American friends. Canadians, no problem. Europeans, no problem. Australians, Kiwis, no problem. But Americans have a difficult time getting 23 days in a row off.
Now, with the, as you mentioned, the winner gets to come back. I assume that means they get comped if they win?
That's absolutely, absolutely. They're entered into the event for free. Their entry cost is waived, and they get to participate and defend their title as the world's greatest travelers.
And besides those who have come back as the champion, are there others who are repeat travelers because they just enjoyed the experience?
Yes, Peter, and this is one of the surprising things that we found. We always thought it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It is truly a whirlwind experience, and one of the reasons why I continually expand and go to more countries, as we've done, is because we have repeat customers that come back every year. We have one team that has come back 10 times. We have multitudes of teams that have come back 4 and 5 times, because they know every year is different and unique, and they also know the collection of travelers traveling with them are just an amazing group of people to get to meet and become lifelong friends with.
Very quickly, the trip comes up in 2020. When exactly does it come up, and how late can somebody enter if they want to take part in 2020, or is it too late?
Sure, it is not too late. We accept applications right up until I actually book airline tickets, and we're always weeding out different people and interviewing people and seeing who's best suited to participate. We leave this year on April the 17th, and I believe we return on May 9th. So April 17th to May 9th, 2020, next spring. People can reach us at globalscavengerhunt.com. That's globalscavengerhunt.com. Or they can also call us at our office at area code 310-281-7809. You can go online, put in an application, and we'd love to consider you and talk to you and see if you're up for this big adventure, a blind date with the world.
Bill, thank you once again for being on the program with us. Safe travels.
Peter, we'll talk to you again in a couple years.
William D. Chalmers, event director for the Global Scavenger Hunt. You can find out more information by going to their website at globalscavengerhunt.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0536, and you'll find all the links. Also, Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear more of our chat with Bill as a Patreon reward extra. After our conversation, we just continued to talk, and I got to delve a little deeper into all kinds of travel-related questions, from how travel has changed over the years, how light or heavy does he pack, what he thinks about airports, what locations really wowed him, and more. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Batteries not included, some assembly required.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Amy Ginsberg Bickel, the co-author of Theodore Bickel's The City of Light. And we'll meet Caroline Weaver, who is the owner of CW Pencil Enterprises, a pencil store in New York City. We also have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com, and whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. We start this next story with a quote. They had planned on getting married prior to Thorne being taken into custody and wanted to follow through regardless of the circumstances. I had promised both I would get it done. Those are the words of Thorne Adderley's defense attorney, Jack Fleischman. Adderley, who is facing felony drug trafficking charges, was married in a West Palm Beach, Florida court by the judge. The bride, 28-year-old Constance Jenkins, was dressed in a pink shirt and striped blouse, while Adderley, who is facing up to 111 years in prison, wore his prison uniform and handcuffs. After the four-minute service was conducted, the newlyweds were not even allowed to kiss. So I suppose the wedding night is out of the question. You know, Constance appears to be an extremely patient woman. She obviously plans to live a very long time, too. And here's a marketing idea that I don't think will fly too far. Or maybe this place is betting that no woman will reveal what she weighs in public. The Fusion Club in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, is offering women free drink credits based on their weight. For example, a woman who weighs 150 pounds would receive about $18.50 in free cocktails. Anil Kumar, spokesman for the club, said that while they have a scale behind the bar, they will also accept a woman's word about what she weighs. They can just write the weight on a paper and give it to the bartender discreetly, he said. Very simple, no strings attached. We want the ladies to surprise their partners and friends that it's good to gain weight. Wow. It's heartwarming to see that the United Arab Emirates is making leaps and bounds in women's rights. First, the right to drive, and now this, being able to drink their weight in cocktails. How progressive. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Manford, Oklahoma only has about 3,500 residents, but they have their own police department. The chief, 44-year-old Lucky Miller, and his best friend and department detective, 49-year-old Michael Neely, traveled to Pensacola, Florida to attend a multi-day training on death scene investigations. You know, how to determine if a death is due to a homicide, suicide, or natural causes, and what evidence to collect to prove it. Lucky was a hands-on guy, said Jerry Ridley, another officer in town, so he always wanted to be there to learn things like that. But the two lawmen didn't make it to the conference. A hotel staffer was sent to their hotel room on a report of a fight. He called police. Chief Miller was on the floor, beaten to death. Detective Neely was arrested, charged with second-degree murder, and is being held on a $1.5 million bond. Gee, if only they had managed to take the class first. I mean, Neely might have been able to better structure the crime scene, or perhaps the ironically named Lucky Miller might have avoided being framed by a chalk outline. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Amy Ginsberg Bickell, the widow of the late actor, singer, and activist Theodore Bickell, has shaped and is sharing her beloved late husband's tale of what he experienced as a little boy during the rise and then explosion of the hatred that preceded the Holocaust. The end result is the book Theodore Bickell's The City of Light. Amy joins us on the line from California to talk about it. Hi, Amy.
Hi. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thank you very much for being on the program with us. As I mentioned to you off-air, just before we started, I had the pleasure and honor of not only speaking to Theodore Bickell in several occasions on this program and a previous program, but I had the opportunity to see him live on stage in Fiddler on the Roof, and it was just an amazing performance. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to share this book and this information with the audience right now. Tell us about this book and how it started and how you have managed to see it through.
Well, in 2014, the editor in chief of Moment magazine, Nadine Epstein, she asked Theo to write any story that he would like for Hanukkah, which would be printed in the magazine and then read on NPR. And so Theo wrote a story, a very short story, about his childhood in Vienna, although he didn't identify the story as being about him, but that is what it was. And it was published in the magazine. It was a beautiful story. And about a year ago, Nadine Epstein approached me if I would like to turn it into a book and publish it. And I did very much. So I expanded the story, so I about doubled the original story that Theo had written in his voice. I know his voice well enough to write as if I'm him. And then I added a foreword and an afterword and a couple of glossaries, and the little story turned into a really beautiful book for children. I think if he was here to see it, he would be immensely proud.
You mentioned you knew Theo's voice. Obviously, as his wife, you would, but what I remember in talking to him is he was so passionate about the topic of sharing his heritage and sharing those stories, and to use a term that is often used, to never forget.
I would say that for Theo, that was the center of his mission. He was driven to share his culture, to share his heritage with everyone, always stressing, as also I told you when we were off air, always stressing that he does that not because he thinks that it's better than the culture or the heritage of any of his neighbors. He often likened humanity to a beautiful garden full of flowers of all shapes and forms. And he would say, my particular flower is the flower of Jewish culture. And I tend to it and I share it, not because it is better or more beautiful than the culture or heritage of my neighbors, but I do it because it's mine. And it's my responsibility to do so. And if I don't do it, this flower will wither and die and no one will know it. And so it gave him great joy and pleasure, but it was also quite a serious, quite a serious mission to go ahead and share everything he could about his Jewish heritage. Theo's childhood stayed with him his entire life. And as I write in the book and the foreword, he really did think about it every day, probably more and more so as he became more aged, which I think is often the case. But he carried the joy of his childhood and the trauma of his childhood with him all of the time. It was never far from his memory. And it's so beautiful to be able to share that amazing story now with our readers.
It is important, as you mentioned, to share that story. It is important to let future generations and younger generations know what had taken place through stories like this. And this is a book that is designed for a younger reader.
Yes, we have this set as age 10 and up. I recently had a couple of afternoons with school children of that age, and I was a little curious and a little bit, worried even. Will they somehow take to this material? Will they like it? Will they be engaged and interested? And these events succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. The children were completely engaged. They had so much to say. All of their arms shot up with every one of my questions. And I found out that the children, these were sixth graders and seventh graders, I found out that they are very not only aware of, these were Jewish children in particular, so they were aware of the Holocaust, which I know is not always the case, but what they were very aware of also was the injustices in our world in this time, in this day, something that I talk about in the book. And they were aware, and they were very aware of their responsibility to take part in fixing the world, a concept that we call in Hebrew tikkun olam, and a concept that for Theo was actually synonymous with his Judaism. He wasn't an Orthodox Jew in any way, but for him what Judaism meant was our ethical and moral responsibility to make the world a better place. And people think, oh, it's children, we shouldn't burden them, we should give them magical unicorns. I'm not putting down magical unicorns, but I think the kids are a lot more engaged and sophisticated than we give them credit for, and they're worried, and they care, and they have very loving feelings towards the people of the world, and they were very happy to be spoken to so directly at eye level.
Since it is a book that is gauged toward a younger crowd, there are some really beautiful illustrations in the book. Tell us a little bit about the illustrators and how that came to be.
Our wonderful illustrator is named Noah Phillips. He's a young man. He did the original illustrations for the story when it was published in Moment Magazine in 2014. And he was, of course, our natural choice to go ahead and illustrate the rest of the book. And we're very pleased with his illustrations. He did a lot of looking at old photos of Vienna. The book takes place in Vienna. So we looked at old illustrations. I sent him some photos of Theo as a young boy, photos that can be seen on our website at theodorebikel.org. So he looked at those photos of Theo, and somehow he came together with this special look for our book, and we couldn't be more pleased.
In literally expounding on Theo's own work for this book, as his widow, how cathartic was this an experience for you?
Well, I've been working with Theo's legacy since he passed away in 2015, and I've done a lot of projects, including going through things that he left behind, putting out publications, doing short documentary film, all kinds of projects I have done since he passed away. And I would say that of all of the projects that I've been involved in, this has been indeed the most cathartic, the most joyful, as I write somewhere in the book, commingling my words with his has been an immense joy and, of course, an immense honor. You know, we're talking about a giant. You know, how could I not feel immensely humbled and immensely honored to have this opportunity to commingle my words with his own? And also, I love shaping this tale, which is at once sad and horrifying in a way, but also so life-affirming. I do stress that Theo grew up to be a joyful, happy, successful man who had a really wonderful life, and that things fell into perspective in some way, and that the bitterness of what happened to him as a child when he was chased out of his beloved city by the Nazis and became a refugee, that bitterness and that sadness did not turn him into a, I don't mean the bitterness, that sadness of what happened did not turn him into a bitter adult full of despair, but quite to the contrary. He took what happened to him and learned this as a lesson and took it as a duty to make sure this never happened again anywhere in the world. And this sadness was transformed into joy because he used his power of his song, the power of his voice, to help others in need. And so coming up so close to that, coming up so close to Theo's legacy, for me, fills me with that sense of urgency and responsibility and joy and gratitude.
Even though this is a book for young readers from either 9 or 10 up, it by no means is a book that should be read only by the youngsters. An adult can get just as much out of this book as anyone else, correct?
Yes, we actually, I mean, to the contrary, I actually envision adults loving the book. And like I said, I knew adults would love it, and I wondered if the children would as well. And I was so gratified just now to be on these occasions where I saw that the children loved it. But I think adults will love having this book. I think they'll love having it on their shelves and sharing it with children and grandchildren. And I think that it will take them back into their own memories and maybe help them figure out little bits and pieces of memories that they're not sure how they fit together. And through reading this book, it'll fit together. Besides having Theo's own story as being a boy in Vienna leading up to the Anschluss, I have a few glossaries at the end of the book that I know that adults will enjoy. One of them is, I don't mean glossaries. I mean, I have a few appendixes, and one of them is a little Yiddish dictionary where I explain that Yiddish is the language that Theo would have been speaking to his family, that was the language of the Jews of the City of Light, and that nowadays, if they ask their grandparents, they'll say that their parents really only spoke it when they didn't want them to understand, which is how everybody thinks of Yiddish, is that language that the parents spoke when they didn't want them to understand. So I recommend to the children that they can have their own secret language with their family if they teach their parents some of these words. And so I'm very happy with our little Yiddish dictionary. And I have a recipe for Theo's grandmother's honey cake, which is what she baked for him in his bar mitzvah, which is mentioned in the book. And then we also have the words and the notes to a Hanukkah song, a little-known Hanukkah song written by the same composer who wrote I Have a Little Dreidel. And Theo recorded it shortly before his death. So there's a link to hear that song, and the notes and the music is in the book. So these are a lot of added attractions. And so we get this very full picture. You know, it's not just, oh, a poor boy that something happened, terrible happened to him, and he doesn't like to remember it. But we actually get a whole lifetime with the joys and the sadnesses and the horrors, you know, and the moments of love. And I like presenting this story in that way.
The book is called Theodore Bickel's The City of Light. Amy, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I thank you so much as well, and I hope that your readers will buy our book and love our book, especially for Hanukkah, but all through the year. And it was wonderful speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Amy Ginsberg Bickel, co-author of Theodore Bickel's The City of Light, a book that she finished following the death of her husband, the multi-talented Theodore Bickel. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0536, and you'll find links to Amy's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about pencils. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. But I've got one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio, and Spotify. A front door camera in McDowell County, North Carolina, twice captured a bold loiterer on the home's porch, a naked man. Sheriff's officers arrested 45-year-old Denny Lynn Dover in early October after identifying him by his distinctive tattoos. Dover had visited the home in April and again on October the 3rd when he attempted to break in. He was charged with first-degree burglary and held on $50,000 bond. Dover isn't new to a life of crime. He also has convictions for arson, drug possession, larceny, peeping, and breaking in. Oh, a Renaissance man. By the way, isn't April and October a little chilly to be walking around naked? Just asking. Anyway. Let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? There's a little store in New York City called CW Pencil Enterprise. It was started online in November 2014 by Caroline Weaver. As their website describes, she's an amateur pencil collector and lifelong pencil lover. Their brick-and-mortar store opened up in March of 2015. Caroline joins us via Skype from New York City to talk about all things pencils. Hi, Caroline.
Hi.
Thanks
for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I discovered your store because a friend of mine from Ontario went on a visit to New York City just recently, walked into your store, loved it, and then saw a pencil that she thought was ideal for me. It says baseball scoring. So she bought the pencil and mailed it to me, and it was lovingly wrapped to make sure nothing went wrong with it. And I was very impressed, and that led me to your website, and I thought, wow, how did this all begin? So let's start there. How did this all begin?
So it was kind of, to be honest, my sort of like joke fantasy retirement job, this whole idea of a pencil shop. It's an object that I've been interested in for my entire life and that I've collected for my entire life. And as I got older and became more interested in the history of it and in the discovery of new pencils that I hadn't seen before through travel or just through talking to other people who are interested in analog tools, I realized that it would be really cool if there was a place where you could try out and see all the pencils, all the good pencils that exist from all over the world. And so this was my like fantasy sort of, if I could have any job, this is what I would do sort of situation. And I moved to New York City and was kind of lost. And one day I woke up and decided that I should just go for it. So I quit my job and I started buying inventory to store in my closets of my apartment and built a website that turned into a brick and mortar shop that turned into a bigger brick and mortar shop. And here we are almost 5 years later.
Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. So first of all, what was your initial attraction to pencils in the first place? What is it about pencils that you love?
I grew up in a really creative household with really creative parents who valued objects like the pencil. And I've always appreciated how simple it is, how perfect in design it is for being such a simple object that's made out of like five different materials. And that's it. And I just have always appreciated how tactile it is. There's a physicality to a pencil that does not exist in any other writing tool. There's no equivalent. That it smells like something and it feels like something and it requires sharpening, which is its own sort of kind of meditative act. It's I don't know, of course I have a tendency to romanticize it, but it's also an object that evokes an intense level of nostalgia for most people. I don't know. I have a lot of reasons for loving it. It has just always been my preferred writing tool.
You said you moved from New York. You moved from where?
I'm from rural Ohio, but I went to college in London and then moved back to New York, having lived here briefly before college, after I graduated.
And what was the job you quit to open up the pencil store?
It was another job in retail, in corporate retail, which taught me a lot about how to run an e-commerce store and how to be good at customer service. But it wasn't what I wanted to do. It was just kind of what I landed in when I moved to New York and needed to find a job.
And as I mentioned, you opened up online first before you went with a brick and mortar. So was that sort of a test run to see if you could do this or what?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, it's a specialty shop like this is challenging because there was no way for me to really properly do market research to figure out what, like, how big my audience would be or anything, because there's no store like it in the world that already existed. So, I mean, and I just couldn't commit the capital of opening a physical shop unless I was sure that it was the right thing. And so I made the website and kind of waited to see how that was going to work out for a few months before deciding to open a physical store. But that was sort of the end game. That's the thing that I feel most invested in, is having a physical space where people can come in and they can talk to us and we can tell them stories and they can test things out and they can hang out for the whole day and test every single pencil if they want to. That's the most important thing to me, is that there's an experience involved.
Okay. What exactly is a pencil story? Like, give us an example. Do you know? I assume you know the history of pencils. I assume there's a broad variety of pencils, even though most people might not be aware of that. How many different pencils are in your shop, or do you have access to that you can order for customers?
In our shop on any given day, there's about 250 different types of pencils. And a lot of them are really interesting, and a lot of them come from really far out places in the world, places where these companies really just create their product for their home market to support a need for these things. And they don't export because it's just their pencil. Like we have pencils from Pakistan and from Portugal and from Japan and from Denmark, from France, from pretty much everywhere that still makes pencils. But we have a pencil that is made by a company called Viking in Denmark, that is a pencil that was commissioned by Danish authorities for voting. So if you're voting in an election in Denmark, that's the pencil you would use. But it's also a really bizarre, very chunky, very soft pencil that people really love to use for drawing. We have a pencil that is the current version of the first yellow pencil ever. It's called the Kohinoor 1500, and it comes from the Czech Republic, and it was first introduced at the World's Fair in Paris in the late 1800s as the first yellow pencil to ever exist. And that's what kind of sparked this trend of the yellow pencil, which we're now very familiar with, especially in America. But there's a story for almost everything that we sell, about either who makes it or what function it serves or where it comes from, or the families who make these things. A lot of these companies are very old and they're still family owned, which is interesting. There's a lot of family history involved with the pencil.
Well, as far as where they come from, is there a particular country, a particular region that is considered to be ground zero for the pencil, where it either is very, very popular or has deep, deep roots?
Definitely Germany. The modern pencil was mostly developed in Germany. It was kind of a worldwide effort during the Industrial Revolution to find a way to make a pencil not by hand. But originally, the first like commercial pencils were made by hand by cabinet makers in Germany, as early as the 1700s, where they would literally like cut by hand pieces of wood that they would carve out a space and put like a sliver of pure graphite into. And now graphite cores are made from a number of materials, and it has to be ground and fired in a kiln, kind of like a ceramic, a method that was actually developed by a hot air balloon engineer that was commissioned by one of Napoleon's generals during the Anglo-English War, or the Anglo-French War. So it's mostly in Europe, mostly Germany. Yeah, but there's a lot of history even in the U.S. In the mid-1800s of pencil makers in mostly Massachusetts, just like general New England area. Henry David Thoreau, the writer, his father was kind of like the founding father of the American pencil. And Henry David Thoreau worked in pencil making before he was ever even a writer.
And in this day and age, who are your clientele? Are they people who, like you, are lovers of pencils, or people who, for their job, require using one?
It's a little bit of everything. I mean, we on weekends we'll have families come in, and they're just, and the kids and the parents will all kind of buy like the things that they think are interesting for school or just for general use, and it's like a fun experience for their family. Or we do have a lot of people who come in who have very specific requirements for their jobs, whether they are tattoo artists or orchestra librarians or magazine editors, or even like accountants. We have a lot of customers who are lawyers, a lot of customers who are writers as well, and artists. But a lot of these professions that we, I guess, kind of aid in supplying pencils for are a little bit unexpected. It's really not just writers and artists, which is what I think most people expect. We have a huge demographic of musicians and orchestra librarians, especially, who shop here.
I noticed by going to your website, which is cwpencils.com, that you also have mechanical pencils, which I have to confess are my weakness. and not only do you have mechanical pencils, you also have accessories like sharpeners and the like. Tell us what you have in addition to the pencils that aid pencils.
Oh yeah, we have lots of really wonderful pencil accessories that most people don't realize exist that actually solve a lot of problems that most people have with pencils. Like pencil caps are very important because you stick it on the end of your pencil and it protects the point. It keeps the pencil from getting your bag or your pencil case dirty. We have beautiful pencil clips that are, we even have some that are gold plated that are made by a manufacturer in New England that you just kind of slide onto your pencil, and they're really elegant, and you use it to clip your pencil to your notebook or to your pocket. There's a thing called a pencil extender, which is a small tool that you can insert a very short pencil stub into, so you can really get as much life as possible out of your pencil. There's so many little accessories that are really, really useful.
And do you have a favorite pencil yourself?
You know, I don't. I kind of feel like I'm not allowed to. It's like choosing a favorite child. But I generally prefer slightly softer pencils, but ones that have good point retention, which is kind of the unicorn of pencils. But a lot of the sort of like higher tech Japanese pencils fit the bill. Or I really just like a good like American-made traditional just kind of scratchy pencil. There's something really lovely about like an audible scratchiness to a pencil. It really enhances the experience sometimes, I think.
And you have your brick and mortar store, but when it comes to online, how far afield do your customers come from? I'm assuming they're not just in New York.
Oh, no, we have customers from all over the world. I think we've probably shipped to like 80% of the countries in the world. We have customers everywhere, and we ship internationally and sell a lot of things that are very hard to find in most places in the world. So, yeah, we have customers everywhere.
Well, congratulations. We should mention again the website if people want to order pencils, cwpencils.com. All the information is there. Caroline, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you for having me.
Caroline Weaver from CW Pencil Enterprise in New York City. You can check out their website at cwpencils.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0536, and you'll find links to Caroline's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Police teased a wanted thief after he tried to evade capture by disguising himself with a pair of glasses. 30-year-old David Springthorpe was being hunted by officers in the UK for breaching a court order as well as a number of shoplifting offenses, but they didn't have to look too far to find the crook after spotting him in the street, despite his attempts to change his appearance and image with simple specs. Social media users poked fun at the effort after officers posted a pair of mugshots online, one with the glasses and one without. Many were quick to ridicule the attempt, with one pointing out how the disguise did nothing to conceal his massive ears and neck tattoo. Springthorpe was subsequently charged with the theft of several perfume gift sets from Boots and jail for 30 weeks. Now, why, oh why, would you think that merely putting on a pair of clear eyeglasses, circa 1960s Michael Caine, would make for an adequate disguise? One reason, and one reason only. And it's not because you're Clark Kent. No, it's because you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0536. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0536. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.